scientists by training, and it's not common that I go to a statistics conference, and so I'm certainly very happy to be able to share some of what we have been doing on robust statistics with you. A lot of what I will be talking about is joint work with Dr. Ed Noor, who was my PhD student, and Ruben Smart. So let me first of all explain the title, because particularly the distance-based outliers, I think those are not the three words that are certainly not a household name, and so I think I need to explain that to you. So let me give you a quick overview of the focus of our work. At the highest level, I think that the general thesis of our work or of this project is we want to be able to show that we can efficiently identify meaningful outliers in large multidimensional data sets. And in my overview that I'm going to give in the next half an hour or so, there will be three main parts that I will like to share with you. First, I want to talk a little bit about identifying distance-based outliers. And then I want to talk a little bit about some of the work we have done on explaining outliers. And of course, relevant to this audience, the third part, which is the more, which is the main part of what I'm going to talk about, is in fact robust space transformation. Now, before all of this, let me actually give you the motivation of how we look at outliers in the context of our work and in the context of the applications that I have encountered. In robust statistics, and I think in many other techniques, typically outliers are treated as noises or what I call second-class citizens. That is, you have some job that you have to do, you have some kinds of things, you have some tasks that you want to be able to achieve, but they are outliers, and now you need to get your job done in spite of the presence of outliers. Now, in our work, we turn this around somewhat because we actually want outliers to be treated as first-class citizens, primarily because they may be interesting on their own rights. And the quotes that I want to leave here is that one person's noise is another person's signal. So what to one task, some objects or some data points may appear to be a noise points, but for some other tasks, for some other applications, they may in fact be very, very meaningful. I have encountered many applications in this outlier detection context, and I think by and large, one huge class of applications for work like this is surveillance applications. So in a few slides later, I will very briefly summarize for you some of the... there's one case where we are using video surveillance data. After September 11, there's now a newfound interest on works of this kind. But the idea is that you get data which is not your standard, not the standard types of data, because the data may in fact be a two-dimensional spatial temporal trajectory. So you have path data, and then in this context we want to analyze, we want to identify people whose path are outlying. And another applications that I did 2-3 years ago was for the Workers' Compensation Board. So this is an agency that needs to monitor all the employers for injury claims of the employees. And they apply the outlier detection technique for two main purposes. The first one is obvious, is try to find all the employers who have an exceptionally high rates of claiming injuries. And so the application then is then WCB can send more inspectors and kind of look over the shoulders of those guys and try to find out what happened to them. A second application, which I did not expect at the beginning, was that they in fact try to find not only the exceptionally bad guys, but they also want to find exceptionally good guys, because they want to identify those employers and try to understand why they are doing so well compared with all their peers, and hopefully they can set up an educational model for the peers so that they can reduce employees' injuries. So these are some applications, and so from this point of view, you might want to ask, and there's a very the immediate question you want to ask as well. See, in those applications, what is an appropriate notion of outliers? And I'm going to use the most liberal definition of an outlier and say that an outlier is an object which differs sufficiently from a great majority of other objects. And the quote here is that even when I was a lot younger, had the time to watch Sesame Street, and they always kind of show you all these diagrams and say, okay, which one stands out? And this is basically what we are doing. Now, the notion, so the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to present this notion of distance space outliers. As you can see, and before I press enter, the notion of distance space outliers is really like a direct encoding of the intuitive definition. Okay. So this is the formal definition. We want to say that an object O in the data set T is the distance space outliers with two parameters, P and D. P stands for the fraction of the objects in the data set that are beyond a certain minimum distance from that object O. So in this particular example, we say that O is the DBPD outliers if in a small neighborhood, in a D neighborhood, there are very few points around it. Most of the other objects in the data set are so far away from this point. And that is the definition of what we call the distance-based outliers. The example that I give here is that if I would say that, well, I call something a distance-based outliers of 0.99,5, if 99% of all other points are at least 5 units of distance away from this particular object. If that is the case, then I call object O a distance-based outliers. Okay, so this is solely based on distances. Let me say a few words about existing outlier detection techniques, and I'm sure you guys know more than I do on this subject. Roughly say that one common way to do, and is very useful to do, is to use box plots and scatter plots and all the common plotting techniques. And as you all know, this is only meaningful if the dimensionality of the data set is very low, 2D, 3Ds, and in some cases 4Ds. There's also model-based, distribution-based techniques where you have this concordancy test. The Barnett and Lewis textbook has many, many such tests. And here you might need to have the notion, you might need to have the knowledge of prior knowledge of the distribution, and if you don't, you might want to do some model fitting and try to find out whether your data set fits into well understood or standard distributions. You might need to worry about number of outliers and things like that. Now, a not so typical technique is the depth-based methods, peeling depth, depth contours, regression depth, a lot of Peter's work. And the general idea is that the shallow layers are more likely to contain outliers. If you want to detect outliers, maybe you want to look at all the data points that have very small depth, and then look at them. The complication or the limitation of this category of methods is that the complexity is very high and is typically only suitable for small values of k. And throughout this talk, I'm going to use the symbol k to denote the dimensionality of the space. Okay? Now, one of the things I want to say is that for depth-based methods, and in fact for some of the methods that I I have mentioned, I think the assumption is always that the extreme points, that the outliers are only confined to the extreme points. So if I have a data set where there's a lot of points that are on the outside, but right at the kind of the center of the point cloud, there's this single lonely object here from the point of view of distance space outliers, that would be flagged as a distance space outliers, but for many of the other techniques, because it's right in the center, then the interpretation is totally different. Okay. So, please welcome to interrupt me if you have any questions you want to ask at any point. So now let me go to the first part of what I want to share with you in terms of our work. And this is a very quick overview, and it's basically saying that there are certain salient features for distance-based outliers. It's not parametric, they not the extreme points. And being a computer scientist, our focus here is to focus on the computational issues. And so algorithmically, one of the most attractive aspects of distance-based outliers is that the computation is not, unlike some of the other methods, it's not exponential with respect to the dimensionality, k, of the data set, but it's in fact quadratic. And so this is a technique that's particularly suitable for large values of k, where large here, I mean maybe above 10, 15, 100, and so on. I was mentioning earlier that we have this application that we have done where we have a video camera monitoring how people pass by a certain hallway, and from the data. So this camera is able to track the movement of people as they walk along that hallway. So for everybody who passed by, we get a two-dimensional spatial-temporal trajectory out of it. And then we apply this technique to define a distance function, and then we identify that, oh, they are, I mean, most of the people, let's say, there are three ways that people typically walk by this hallway, but then from time to time, there are odd people who took a very special way of walking by this hallway. One example that I gave was that people might generally be walking with a uniform speed, but then from time to time there may be one person who initially walked very, very slowly and then walked around and then all of a sudden ran, because in the spatial-temporal trajectory we can also calculate the speed of the person. So the idea here is, well, maybe somebody was trying to first try to look around and then maybe steal something and then wanted to run away very, very quickly. So because of the trajectory, we were able to identify those very outlying things. One more slide about algorithm. There's actually an optimized algorithm that are in fact linear with respect to the number of objects. But for this technique, it's only suitable for small values of k, let's say k less than or equal to or 5. For 5-dimensional data sets, this technique would work well, but if it is higher dimensional, then you have to go back to the... I can't go back to here. Then you have to go back to the previous algorithm, which I mentioned, and because we intend to deal with very large data set, it's unreasonable for us to assume that the data set will always fit in its entirety in main memory. So we did our work to make sure that it has good computational properties, particularly in terms of IOs, and we guarantee there's at most 3 passes over the data. So this is the only thing that I want to say as far as the overview on distance-based outlier identification. Let me say a little bit about explanation, because I think it's a very intriguing concept to maybe to some of you whenever I have a chance to talk to statisticians, and so I think I should say a little bit. From the people that I have worked with, so let's say take Workers' Compensation Board as the example. They are interested to find the outliers, but oftentimes they also want to know a little bit more. They want us to be able to explain to them why such an employer is in fact flagged as an outlier. So we want to provide more knowledge of a specific form and, in our case, structural information. So we want to not only say that a certain object is an outlier, we want to say that this is the set of dimensions that explain the uniqueness of the outlier. And we want to also have a way of comparing one outlier with another. And we introduce the notion of strongest and weak in a structural sense, and we develop algorithms to how to compute them efficiently. And I don't want to dwell too much on the computational aspect here, but I will just spend two slides that explain to you how we define strongest and weak outliers. So we say that, so this is definition one. So we say that an object P is the strongest outliers in a space A sub P if no outlier exists in any subspace of A and any subspace of the AP space. And by the definition of the distance space outliers, if A is already an outlier in a space A sub P, then A is a trivial outlier in all the superspaces of A and P. So in this diagram here, P would be a strongest out. So in the original space, it's A, B, C, D. It's a four-dimensional space. But not only do we explore in that space, we also explore in all the subspaces. And in this particular case, P may end up to be an outlier in the subspace AB, but because of the fact that there's no outlier in A and B, then we call P the strongest outlier. And because P is an outlier here, P would also be an outlier in ABC. And so we just ignore the P, and that would be a trivial outlier. So then the question here now is, what is Q? Well, Q is just a weak outlier because Q is an outlier in the space ABC. In one subspace, there already exists some outlier. So therefore, we say that, well, Q is an outlier, but it's not as strong as P, because P is really arguably the most interesting. And let me give a complete picture here. So in this example, the original space is a five-dimensional space, A, B, C, D, E, and all the subspace can be organized as a lattice. And in fact, what we are doing, or as a semi-lattice if you ignore the empty set. So the idea is that if I start from the order subspace with only one dimension, I might be able to find out that there are outliers in A and D, and then BC also has the strongest outlier here without because B and C do not have any outliers. And this is a specific example that we use based on National Hockey League data. So for those of you who are Canadians or who are familiar with hockey, this might in fact be a more meaningful slide. We were just analyzing hockey players, and we find out that, for example, this guy Lemieux is in fact an outlier even on this A subspace, not to speak of A, B, C, D, E. And in fact, he's also a strongest outlier in the subspace of B and C. So you can see that this guy Lemieux is in fact a very, very special player because there are so many dimensions that he is very unique. And so this is the kind of things that we do. Now let me go on to the last part of my talk, and I think that would be the part that could be the most interesting to many of you. Now, so far, I've never talked about we're talking about distance-based outliers. One question is, well, gee, what distance functions are we talking about? Do we always know what is an appropriate distance function? The work that I've presented so far, by and large, assume that we are talking about weighted Euclidean distance. And as you can easily see, this may not be appropriate for many situations because there may be data sets that will have very differing scales, differing variability, correlation, and outliers. So we need to find a way to fairly compare attributes to get meaningful results. And so the question is, well, yeah, distance space is fine, but well, what is the distance function? What is an appropriate space that we can in fact analyze the data? Now, a simple motivating example is that if I have a data set of objects, and each object is a vector of size 3, which captures the blood pressure of the patient, the body temperature of a patient, and the age of a patient. And you know that the mean for blood pressure is 120 millimeter, and the body temperature is 37. And let's say that in this particular data set, the mean of the age is 16. What would be a distance function that compares, that would give meaningful comparisons? Because it's not rare to see people with a blood pressure that's 150, 180. So even a distance of 60 may not be that significant. But if you have a body temperature that is 40 degrees Celsius, then you better go to the hospital because this might mean that you have a very, very high fever. Now, you may say that, well, there are simple ways of dealing with this. One way is you can normalize the ranges. You can use weighted Euclidean distance, but the question is, how do you find the weight? You can standardize the ranges minus by mu divided by sigma. And I suppose that the reason why I'm talking to you here is because our solution, and in fact it turns out, to be validated by empirical results, is that it works a lot better if we use a robust space transformation. The specific one that we use is Donahoe style estimator, and this is the slide that I think in this room I might be the least qualified to talk about things like this. But let me just quickly say that we look at some of the some candidates for robust estimators, and we ended up picking DSE primarily because it has very good, it has the properties here, and I don't think so far I have any regret that we have picked DSE. So now, and again, I don't think you need me to tell you about this, but I'm going to talk about this primarily because it really set up the foundation for the algorithms, and I want to talk to you about how to compute them, and so that's why I need to set up the framework. So the idea is that for the points in your point cloud, the points are projected onto projection vectors, and then you want to find out which points are outlying on the projection vector, and you want to try many projection vector. So in the first diagram, the projection vector is this line. So you project all these points down to the projection vector for this. In this particular case, B is outlying, but not A and C. And then you pick another projection vector. Let's say that this time is parallel to the minor axis. And it turns out that in this case, B and C is not outlying, but A is. Okay, so you have all these projection vectors. Now, let me give you the skeleton algorithm for the DSE scatter matrix. So for each projection vector that you select, you project all the endpoints onto the projection vector, compute each point's outlyingness value, keep track of, and then you pick the largest outlyingness value for each point across all projection vectors, and then you compute the robust covariance matrix by downweighting each point according to its largest outlyingness value, and you come up with a weighting function. So this is a skeleton. Okay. Now the key question for us from a computational point of view is, well, what is a good set of projection vectors for us to use? And so this is mainly the main question that we try to answer by developing various algorithms and try to compare them empirically. So the first method is in fact proposed by Donahoe and Steihel when they publish their paper, and it's an exhaustive algorithm that says that, well, why don't I try fixed increment of my space? And as you can imagine, it's very CPU intensive. It gives you a very high quality estimator, but the time that it took is tremendous. And in fact, I have been in computer science for 20 years, and that was the first time that I tried an algorithm, and the algorithm ran for so long that it actually caused the CPU to burn. And this is actually true, that Edno submitted his job a few days earlier, before the weekend, and on Monday he came back and just wanted to check on the job, and then he realized that the machine was down. So he talked to the technical staff, and then the technical staff said, "Oh, for some reason there was a CPU overheating problem, and the CPU was burned." And so, so this is a very exhaustive method, and we ran this algorithm mainly trying to use it as a yardstick for quality. I mean, this is not really for practical use. Now, then there's a subsampling algorithm that I think proposed by Starhill, and the idea is that, well, why don't we use projection vectors orthogonal to axis of the hyperellipsoid? This is also a very computational intensive algorithm, not as bad as the previous one. And one of the question is that in order to have this algorithm running, we need to figure out what is the number of subsamples that are needed, and we did some calculation, and so that's the subsampling algorithm. Now, you can say, well, why don't I just do it by chance, right? I mean, chance is not necessarily that bad. As we see in many applications before. So you can have a pure random algorithm. And you just randomly pick some projection vector from the space. Now, the interesting thing is that it can run for a long time, but sometimes if you are lucky, the results are amazingly good, right? So the question is, well, gee, this is not very reassuring if we don't really have a good guarantee of when this is going, how long this is going to run. So the algorithm that we have developed is called hybrid random, which is really trying to merge the subsampling algorithm with the pure random algorithm, and it consists of two phases. The first phase is that it uses a small number of subsamples to some extent to bootstrap the process, and I don't want and I try to be very careful about using this word because I know that bootstrapping has a very specific connotation in a statistics context. But I'm using that word mainly from a computer science context. I just want to reboot the computer, and so in this sense, I want to have a good starting point, and we use subsampling as a good starting point, and then we want to randomly generate other projection vectors to improve the quality of the subsampling algorithm. Now the question is, how can we do that? So the idea that we come up with that is that with the assumption that projection vectors that are too close to each other will give me more or less similar results, and therefore I don't want them. So the idea is that, well, for each projection vectors that I have already examined, maybe I should set up a buffer zone, and then I want to generate randomly outside of the buffer zone. So let me give you a 2D example. So these are two projection vectors that I know I've examined. And for each of them, I have a buffer zone. And then I just randomly generate projection vectors outside of the buffer zone. In a 3D example, is that I will have, so let's say that I've already examined three projection vectors and they correspond to three cones. And I want to construct these cones, and then I want to randomly generate a projection vectors outside of the cones, and so that's basically how we do the random generation of the projection vectors. It's not a blind random; it's a little bit of in intelligence to try to avoid the cones. And I think it generally works quite well. And let me just give you a executive summary on the empirical evaluation of the different techniques. The fixed angle is certainly, as I mentioned earlier, took a long, long time, typically several orders of magnitudes longer than the other's technique. Subsampling is very interesting because I think it returns a good, it returns very quickly an estimator of modest quality. But if you want to improve the quality of this estimator, it takes a long time. So it gives you a good point, and it kind of improves very, very, very slowly. Okay, and so because of this property, combining with pure random in hybrid sounds very natural, because in a pure random case, you have to be lucky. So sometimes you get very good results very quickly. Sometimes you can try for a long time and you get nothing. So the idea is that why don't we start with a good starting point using subsampling and then using random to try to improve it. And just show you some figures. Don't necessarily read too much into the runtime, because this is assuming that, so this is a table that fixed the quality. So in order to achieve a certain level of quality for all the three algorithms, this show you some runtimes that says that, for example, maybe I should look at this, 100,000 objects in a five-dimensional space, this can take hours and take hours. And then the hybrid random can, in fact, be a lot faster. Okay, so yeah, this is actually my second last slide. So there's a lot of details for the algorithms, and I certainly would very happy to answer your questions and provide more details if you are interested. And the last slide is simply saying that we are continuing to work on this. I think one of the interesting questions for this audience is whether the computational framework that we have developed that seems to work well for the DSE, how much of that knowledge can be generalized to the computation of other estimators. So I think on that note, I would stop. Thank you. Yeah, so that's a very good question. In some of Ed Knorr's work, we were trying to estimate P and D, and provide some initial estimate to the user. So I think I would be lying to you if I say that we have a scientific way of picking P and D, but the way that we have done this is that we will use some estimation technique to try to figure out what an appropriate for a given value of P that the user desires, estimate what that D is, and propose that to the user. And maybe the user doesn't like it, or maybe it gets too many outliers, then you just rerun it. So it's an iterative process involving the user. So that's the it's certainly a subjective thing, and I think that's the right. Do you have anything to add, Ruben? Yeah.
Assuming normal model, you can debug it.
Yeah. Right. So this is also with the assumption that assuming normality, then you can estimate D, but maybe the user doesn't like it, and so the user can certainly set it. Can certainly override the value suggested by the system, and that's what we have done so far.
I like your definition of outlier. One of these things not like the other. And when I work with people in the computer field, the one big thing is that their definition is different from our definitions. And sometimes we give them things that aren't appropriate for what they're doing. And so, for example, in like the examples you're working with. I'll let you tell them I know. There may be a small cluster of data, which you don't want to call helpliners.
Mm-hmm.
And we call them helpliners.
Yeah.
And so as a result, then, there's been an image understanding, a misinterpretation of the techniques we're using. And so in this particular case here, it may not be necessary to actually use a high breakdown point procedure. And also, because you may even have data that comes from different types of clusters. And if you use a high breakdown point procedure, you just think of it as one big data set. And you may want to have more locally adaptable metrics to try to measure the cluster. And so this might be a case where the difference in terminology we could be important to use something.
Yeah. So, oh yeah, so this is the first year that Adnor and I published this work on distance-based outliers was 97, 5 years ago. Since then, this has received a lot of attention in the data mining community. One of the extension to our technique is, in fact, because if you remember the definition that we have used so far, it's a global PND. It's a very global thing. So one group of people has already extended this framework to pick PND in a more local way. And so that to some extent, I think it's similar in spirit to the point that you have made.
If there are no more comments, then let's thank the speaker again.
Right.